From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with comic, writer, actor, and director Albert Brooks. He's starring in the new film, My First Mister. Also, memories of a rock and roll survivor. We talk with Al Cooper. He was a member of the Blues Project and a founder of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. He played on Dylan's Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 Revisited. Now he has a new collection of his greatest and most obscure recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. At the White House today, President Bush signed into law a new anti-terrorism bill that gives sweeping powers to law enforcement authorities. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
In a ceremony in the East Room, the president said the government will enforce this law with all the urgency of a nation at war. The legislation, which passed overwhelmingly in the House and Senate, provides expanded authority to tap telephones, to monitor emails and internet usage, and to detain suspected terrorists.
The bill before me takes account of the new realities and dangers posed by modern terrorists. It will help law enforcement to identify, to dismantle, to disrupt, and to punish terrorists before they strike.
Civil libertarians argue that the measure goes too far, but the White House did compromise with Congress on some items, among them a requirement that some of the bill's provisions expire in 4 years and would need to be reapproved by Congress again at that time. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
The Supreme Court building is the latest Washington, D.C. landmark to undergo anthrax testing. Spores were found today at an off-site facility that processes the high court's mail, but no anthrax spores were found at the court itself, although the court did shut down for the day. A top federal health official says there is probably another tainted letter with anthrax that has not yet been discovered. The head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention bases that belief on the fact that the man who screens mail for the State Department is hospitalized with anthrax. He had no contact with the mail facility where anthrax was found. The Taliban supreme leader is reportedly calling for Muslims worldwide to stage demonstrations in support of the militia's cause. And in Pakistan, tens of thousands of people marched today to protest the American bombings in Afghanistan. Nearly 40,000 people staged a peaceful rally in Karachi. Thousands more rallied in Quetta. The head of the American Red Cross announced her resignation today, saying she was being forced out of the organization. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
Dr. Bernadine Healy has led the American Red Cross since 1999. Lately, she's appeared in television advertisements seeking donations to the organization to assist September 11th recovery efforts. The organization says it's accepting her resignation with regret, but in a news conference, Healy said she was forced out because of policy differences with the board. She pointed to two in particular: her decision to withhold dues to the International Red Cross because it won't accept Israel as a full member, and her refusal to mix disaster relief donations with general funds, an act praised in a Red Cross press release. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 82 points to finish at 95.45 on volume of over 2 billion shares. The Nasdaq was down 6 points and the S&P 500 closed up 4 points. You're listening to NPR News. A union is threatening to sue the U.S. Postal Service to force the closure of a New York mail site contaminated with anthrax spores. A lawyer for the New York Metro Area Postal Union says officials must clean it up and send people back when it's safe. He says he has warned the Postmaster General that the union will sue if the Morgan Processing and Distribution Center remains open. That's where officials have said anthrax spores contaminated 4 mail sorting machines. Former Congressman Gerald Solomon has died. He was a powerful committee chairman in the Republican-led Congress until he retired in 1998. NPR's Peter Overby has more.
Gerald Solomon took no guff from anyone. A crusty former Marine from New York's Hudson River Valley, he was first elected in 1978. And for 4 years in the mid-90s, he ran the House Rules Committee, the traffic cop that decides which bills and which amendments will be debated on the House floor. House Speaker Dennis Hastert said nobody was willing to fight harder for freedom. In 1996, ending a bitterly personal debate on assault weapons, Solomon told Democrat Patrick Kennedy, "Let's just step outside." Solomon ardently supported then-Speaker Newt Gingrich, a constitutional amendment against flag burning, and government support for the dairy farmers in his district. In retirement, he stayed close to Congress by working as a lobbyist. Solomon was 71 when he died of congestive heart failure. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
The Defense Department today picked Lockheed Martin Corporation to build a new fighter jet that could end up costing $200 billion. The contract for the Joint Strike Fighter is the biggest in Pentagon history. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovoSoy Brandeis O'Flavones to consumers throughout the United States on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this edition, we hear from comic writer, actor, and director Albert Brooks. He's starring in the new movie, My First Mister. Our film critic John Powers has called Brooks the funniest man in America and our leading satirist of middle-class self-indulgence. Brooks also wrote, directed, and starred in the films The Muse, Mother, Real Life, Modern Romance, Lost in America, and Defending Your Life. He also appeared in the film Taxi Driver as a campaign worker and co-starred in Broadcast News as an insecure journalist. He started his career as a stand-up comic. One of his classic comedy routines is called Rewriting the National Anthem. Yesterday, our linguist Jeff Nunberg talked about American anthems and how they sound after September 11th. Here is Albert Brooks's pre-September 11th critique. The premise is that the national anthem is so difficult to sing, we should hold auditions for a new one. Here's how he imagined the auditions might sound.
Dan Allen, Denver, Colorado. Miles from coast to coast, every citizen has reason to boast. Thank you. Thank you. Can the lights be changed at all? All right, it's not important. Before I sing my song, I should tell you a bit about myself. My name is Mr. Robert Bob Harmon. And I currently live and work in the very exciting city of Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm an entertainer. And you know, Vegas is a great place, an exciting place, but originally I'm from a much quieter place, a place up north, out west, a place I call Portland. What a great place it is. In one 30-square-mile radius, there's more to do than almost anywhere in the world. There's hunting and fishing and boating and camping. Get on with it! I am. It's how I get into it in the actor. It's got beautiful waterfalls and gorgeous trees, but you know, it's part of a bigger place. It's part of a country. Can you guess which country it is? No, it's not Denmark or Poland or Sweden or Rome. Get on with it! It's a lovely place I call home, I'm proud to say. I've got a country. Got a country. I spell it A-M-E-R-I-C-A. Get off the stage! Thank you. Thank you.
Albert Brooks from his first comedy album, Comedy Minus One. I spoke with Brooks in 1996 after the release of his film, Mother.
In some of your early work as a comic, back when you were doing stand-up, and in some of your really early movie work, you made fun of a certain showbiz kind of comedy.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you must have grown up with that. Your father was a comic.
Yeah. Well, my father died when I was 11, but I still, you know, remember that it was okay to, you know, be funny, and I watched somebody do it for a living, even though he pretty much was out of it by the time I was born. I used to listen. He was a radio comedian. He went under the name of Parkyakarkas, and he was a Greek dialect comedian, and that's the character he played. And even though he was off the air when I was born, we used to have these huge, you know, those big 16-inch records of all the radio shows, and I would listen to it, And I sort of was able to see into show business early, you know. Somehow I got it that it might not be exactly what you think it is.
How did your father, who I assume was Jewish, his name was Einstein, how did he get to play a Greek dialect comic?
Well, he played, you know, during the 40s when he was on the air. I think being an immigrant coming to America was a very popular thing. And I don't know how exactly or where. I know he was born in Boston, and he worked in the advertising business, and I think he just did this character for fun. And then Eddie Cantor heard him once at a dinner, and actually I think thought he was really Greek, and said, talk to him slowly like he wouldn't understand him, would you like to come to New York and be on my show? And my father said, you can talk faster. I'm born in America. And I don't know why he came up with that, but I think the idea of the poor immigrant who comes to America was something that, you know, obviously he liked.
When you started doing comedy, your comedy was it came out of who you were as a real person.
Yeah.
And a lot of your monologues were pretty autobiographical.
Right. I never told jokes. I don't think I've ever told a joke in my life.
Right. So this more autobiographical approach was really different from where your father was coming from, where he didn't even play his own ethnic group, let alone talk about his life.
Absolutely. And that's exactly right. Yeah.
Did you feel like you had any models for what you wanted to do, a more autobiographical approach?
No, I'll tell you, when I was very young, I remember watching Jack Benny and thinking that this man figured it all out. Jack Benny really never told jokes. I mean, look what he did. He would stare and people would laugh, and his persona was so clear. It was so, the audience understood it so well that he really, you know, he was amazing. He was the world's great minimalist.
Is that what you were trying for, to do very little and have it be very effective?
Or just sort of a, you know, those old guys used to play themselves. This is not a new thing. This is one of the original things that radio and television did. George mm-hmm. Burns and Jack Benny and Fred Allen. It was their lives we were laughing at. So I think it was, you know, it just showed you that you didn't have to stand up there and say, my wife is fat. There were other things to do. But actually, the kind of comedy I did, I really didn't see before I did it. So I didn't have a role model in that somebody was making fun of I sort of was making fun of the institutions that were still going on. When I first started, the first thing I ever did was a ventriloquist act called Danny and Dave, which was basically the world's worst ventriloquist. He was introduced as, you know, a real ventriloquist, and his mouth moved more than the dummy, and the dummy used to drink water while he would sing, and, you know, I would do all of those ventriloquist tricks where I would try to smoke a cigarette, and, you know, I just threw the dummy on the floor to get him out of my hand so I could smoke. And, you know, many people laughed, and a couple of people in the very beginning said, that's the worst ventriloquist I've ever seen. So, and this happened in my first movie. When I did Real Life, I played a character called Albert Brooks. And, you know, here was a man named Albert Brooks who set up this whole thing as a realistic experiment of filming a family and trying to make it a sociological experiment. And I would say half the reviews I got in America were real. I still remember, you know, I remember, I'm not sure if it was Rex Reed or somebody who said, why in God's name would a studio give this man money to do such an important experiment? And, you know, I was stunned. I always thought everybody got, you know, figured everything out, but they didn't. And so it just took years to sort of, you know, maybe make a few people realize that this was thought of, and it wasn't just a bad act.
Yeah. So you went from one scene to another. You went from the TV variety shows, which had an older audience, and then you went to opening for rock acts like
that's
like,
right.
Like I Neil sort of, Diamond and Richie Havens. So it's one extreme to another.
Exactly. I did. You know, I sort of had a whole reverse thing because like everybody else does clubs and then gets on television. I did about 5 years of television before I ever performed in front of a live concert audience. I actually remember the first time I ever performed was in Mississippi with Neil Diamond, and I had just done in the previous year, when Merv Griffin was on CBS, I had done like 15 of his shows. And I remember trying to put together bits of a Merv Griffin show to do as a half hour in front of a live audience. I didn't even have the transitions in my mind yet of talking to a group of people because I was so used to these bits. And it was very, sometimes it was fun, but opening for rock acts in the early 70s, I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
Why not?
Well, it was way before comedy was in or even, you know, popular in any regard. You know, comedy sort of didn't start to get this popularity until, I guess, were the 80s. And let's face it, these people took a lot of drugs and went to see, you know, they wanted to hear the loudest music they could hear. And I think there's an old Chinese adage that says 16 sleeping pills does not make for a good comedy audience. You know, they took a lot of these downers and would sit there and they were waiting for, you know, Sly and the Family Stone, and the disc jockey had to come out and tell them I was there.
Right, and you were going to come on and talk about things that made you neurotic and insecure.
Right there. Yeah, stop. It doesn't matter. It's called talk about. It's not.
Right,
it's not
right.
The human voice they were waiting to hear. They wanted to hear these amplifiers turned up to a billion decibels. They wanted to be hurt, you know. So I had some very rough experiences trying to get people to listen. I remember once I did open for Sly, and it was in Tacoma, Washington, and the show was at 8 o'clock, and my phone rang at 7:30 in the hotel, and actually a motel, a little teeny room there, and it was Sly and the Family Stone. It was his manager, and at that time it wasn't a secret. Sly was, you know, experimenting with Columbia's most famous product, and I don't mean the studio. And so the guy said to me, he said, let me ask you something, Albert. How long do you do? I said, well, you know, normally a half hour, but I'm a little worried about this audience, maybe 20 minutes. He said, you know, and now we're in Tacoma. He said, what's the longest you can do? I said, well, I don't know. Why? Well, Sly called, and he's in Cincinnati. he had missed the plane. I said, what? He's in Cincinnati? I said, well, you know, what are you talking about? I got to do 3.5 hours? Well, actually, it would be longer because he can't get a plane until 7. I said, look, you got the wrong guy here. I don't know if I should even go on. So I actually did go on, and I remember somebody threw a beer can and cut my leg, and I got angry at the audience. I started to yell at them and said, he's not even here, and I'm going to go on Johnny Carson and tell them that you're horrible, and as if they would all stop and go, ooh. Anyway, I just got out of town quickly. I ran off the stage. It was not fun.
So you could have said you had 2 hours left and then taken questions from the audience for the next 2 hours.
Oh, yeah, questions, right. Like, how do you want to be killed, fire or knife? That would have been the question. No, it was bad. And I'll tell you what I did do. I still remember. I went back because all their equipment was there. And I started to just play a bass note like the beginning of a Supreme song. Boom, 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 boom. And they all quieted down. And I couldn't play. And so, you know, I was just quiet. They just were ready. And I tried to say very patiently, he's not even here. But, you know, they didn't care. They weren't in the mood to be polite. And I think drugs and comedy don't go well.
Yeah. My guest is comic, writer, actor, and director Albert Brooks. He's starring in the new film, My First Mister. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Albert Brooks is starring in the new film My First Mister. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with him in 1996 after the release of the film Mother, which he wrote, directed, and starred in. He played a middle-aged man in the early stages of a divorce. He knows he screwed up, and he blames his insecurities on his hypercritical mother, played by Debbie Reynolds. In an attempt to understand what went wrong in his relationship with his mother, he moves back in with her. As soon as he walks in the door, he knows he's in trouble.
Want something to eat?
No.
I made some salad, and I have some meatloaf.
I don't eat meat.
Oh, that's right. This Jeff who loves it.
I'll have some salad.
Well, don't have salad just for my sake.
No, I'll have it.
Are you sure you want salad?
Yes, I want salad.
Well, not just for my sake.
Mother, I don't get into this food stuff now, please. Just give me a little salad.
Oh, I know what I could do. I could scrape the top off the meatloaf.
What would that do?
Well, it wouldn't be as much meat then.
But it's still meat. What difference does it make how much you have?
You really don't like meat, huh?
No, Mother, I don't like eating cows.
Oh, honey, everything comes from a cow. Everything.
The classic Jewish mother in a lot of American fiction and movies is the critical, domineering, overprotective mother. The mother in your movie is critical, but she doesn't care quite enough about the son. So she's not domineering and overprotective. The son almost wishes that she was.
Right. Nor do I think this is a Jewish mother, but because the Jewish mother is too, as you know, such a cliche of exactly what you say. And I don't. I wasn't out to make it a particular religion. I think that, you know, there are two kinds of mothers on the planet, no matter what religion or who they are, and that's either the mothers that think everything their children do are perfect, or the other kind. And this is about the other kind. They can be Catholics, Protestants, Jews, or atheists. It's just the idea that, you know, they're critical. However, the real mothers, the mothers that I have met, once the children leave, they don't want them back. Who would want them back? Did you ever see a bird when the other birds leave the nest? They tear down the nest and find a tree and don't tell the other birds where that tree is. So it's, you know, the idea that they want children back is silly to me. And that's the cliche part. Being critical isn't.
So is your mother really critical?
Well, she's, you know, loving, but she's, it's not, and I wouldn't even call it critical. My mother has always sort of been puzzled why I'm who I am. And I think one of the reasons is that if my mother and I, if there was one thing we didn't share, it probably was she didn't get my sense of humor. You know, sense of humor is a very personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can love a child and still have no idea why other people are laughing at them. So I think that my mother was always sort of, I mean, I know from doing, I must have done 50 Tonight shows when, you know, Carson was hosting, and the audience would laugh their head off, and my mother and I would always have the same conversation after every show, which was basically I would say, did you see it? And she would say, oh, honey, it was wonderful. What did Johnny think? And I would say, well, he liked it, but did you like it? No, of course, honey, but Johnny liked it. You know, so that was going to be my autobiography title, What Did Johnny Think?
Now, there's some very funny things about food. You know, your character mm-hmm. comes back to the mother's house, and she saves a lot of food in the freezer, where it's guaranteed to taste really bad after a while.
Yes.
And she buys all those horrible store brands in the movie. It's Sweet Tooth Sherbert.
Yes, I made that up.
Oh, is it perfect, though?
Yes.
So was this a problem at your home, too, that your mother would buy all the cheap brands?
That part is my mother could afford anything, but she just didn't believe that there was, you know, like Debbie says in the movie, honey, there's no difference. The man in the store told me it's just the label. I think that my mother probably has said that to me. I really think that somewhere in the back of her mind, she felt that all food came from the same vat in Chicago and they just, you know, put on a different label somewhere.
Did you ever go ahead.
I'm saying, I mean, we had brands of food. They looked like the real thing. I mean, like the cookies, you know, they were black with white in the middle, but it was like, you know, Sorios. It was one letter off. And, you know, there's a thing that I love in this movie, this sherbet that's been in the freezer for about 16 years and you can't even see it anymore. And I say to, you know, my mother in the movie, I say, look at this crap that sits on the top, and she has named it. She says, oh, no, honey, you look under the protective ice.
Yeah, I love the protective ice. Yeah.
I said, you've named this stuff? I can't believe it. But my mother still, to this day, my mother has this Neapolitan ice cream. There aren't three colors anymore. It's just one color it's blended into. I don't know what that color is even, but the chocolate and vanilla and strawberry have long ago stopped being divided. They just are like a light yellow. My mother does the funniest thing about my movies. Well, first of all, I know what you're going to ask. What did she think?
Oh, did she get the jokes?
Oh, yeah. The first thing she said is, you know, honey, I think one or two things are from us. I said, one or two things? It's an hour and 40 minutes. And my mother praised me. She liked this the best. And she praises me by using my other movies. She says, I think this is going to be the most popular because in this one you don't have to die or drop out. Or I said, I know, I get it. I understand what you're saying. But you know something? She really did like this. I can tell. I know my mother, and I think that she loved it.
Albert Brooks recorded in 1996. He's starring in the new film, My First Mister. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Somebody that just loves to learn, and another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them, you see it's in the blood. Both kids are good and mom, blood's thicker than the mud. It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
It's a family affair.
What a bear. What a bear.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers, and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Al Cooper talks about his years with Blood, Sweat, and Tears and about playing the now classic organ line on Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. Cooper has a new collection of his greatest and most obscure recordings.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Al Cooper, has a new double CD called Rare and Well Done that collects his greatest and most obscure recordings from 1964 to 2001. Cooper played in the Blues Project, then co-founded Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and wrote most of their early songs. He played on Dylan's albums Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 Revisited, and played the famous organ line on Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. Cooper also played on recordings by the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix, and George Harrison, and produced records by Lynyrd Skynyrd, Nils Lofgren, and Rick Nelson. One of the previously unreleased tracks on his new CD is his 1964 demo of his song Something Going On, which he wrote for Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
You know, I woke up this morning. The first thing I did was to look into your eyes. And in that space where I used to find so much truthfulness, there was a stone cold pack of lies. You know, something going on. Something going on, but I don't know what it is. You know, something going on, people. I gotta get to the bottom of it.
Al Cooper started his career when he was still a teenager. At the age of 13, he became the guitar player in the Royal Teens after they had their hit Short Shorts. And through his new connections, he started writing songs for pop performers, working out of one of the New York buildings on Broadway that headquartered many of the pop writers of the 50s and early 60s. I spoke to Al Cooper in 1998, after he revised and expanded his memoir, Backstage Passes. Your big pop success as a songwriter was This Diamond Ring, which was recorded by Gary Lewis and the Playboys, Gary being Jerry Lewis's son. And you say in your memoir that you wrote that song with an R&B group like the Drifters in mind. So how did it end up being performed by Gary Lewis instead of the Drifters?
Boy, beats the hell out of me. I was amazed. My publisher at the time, Aaron Schroeder, saw me in the hallway and he said, well, we got a record on that Drifter song you wrote. I said, oh, the Drifters cut it? He said, no. Snuff Garrett cut it. Snuff Garrett was a West Coast producer known for producing Bobby V and people like that. And I said, since when is Snuff Garrett cutting R&B records? He said, well, he's not. I said, oh, dear. He said, well, I have the record. Do you want to come upstairs and hear it? I said, well, just out of curiosity, I'd like to hear what Snuff Garrett did with This Diamond Ring. And so I went upstairs and he played the record and I was just heartsick. I thought it was terrible. I admonished him after he played the record and said, you know, I don't even waste my time playing me things like this again. That's the worst thing I ever heard.
Of course, it became a huge hit.
Yeah, 2 months later, it was number one in the country. And I say, hey, I wrote that song.
Now, what do you think about the arrangement now?
Oh, I still hate it. I still think it's an insipid, horrible record. And as a matter of fact, I went in later years and at much expense to my credibility, recorded the song on one of my solo albums to show people where it came from and what it was like, because I actually think it's a good song. I just couldn't stand the Gary Lewis interpretation.
Okay, we're going to hear both of those versions back to back. We're going to hear the Gary Lewis version and then the version that you cut with the arrangement that you originally had in mind, the version you cut in the 1970s. So here
you know,
we go.
It's even funnier if you play it the other way around. If you play mine first and then play Gary Lewis's, which is, you know, the way I saw it. It's even funnier that way.
I'm willing to give that a shot. Is our engineer ready
okay.
to do that? Our engineer's ready to do that. Let's go. So this is Al Cooper, followed by Gary Lewis's version of Al Cooper's song, This Diamond Ring.
Thank you. this diamond ring don't shine for me anymore. And this diamond ring don't mean what it did before. So if you've got somebody whose love is true, won't you let it shine for you now?
Okay, Al Cooper, guess what? I like the Gary Lewis version. I'm not saying I don't like yours, but I like the Gary Lewis version. I think it's a fun pop hit.
Well, so did many millions of people.
Is the interview over now?
It's a sad thing.
No, but it's pop. I mean, it's you know, it's got a...
It's happy. You can do the math to it. It's, you know...
you don't like that kind of, like, kettle drum or whatever is on there?
Timpani, no. Timpani, it's great in, you know, certain things. It was great in the 1812 Overture.
So what did the Gary Lewis version do for your career? Did it help it a lot?
Yeah, it helped it tremendously as a songwriter. Right after that, we had another top 20 record by Gene Pitney called I Must Be Seeing Things. And
want to sing a few bars of that to refresh our memory?
Well, I'll recite the opening lyrics. I used to write the music, and I wrote with two other guys, and they wrote the words, as I was sort of lyrically deficient at the time, and actually lyrically challenged at the time. And this one, typical of its time, said, "Isn't that my girl? And is that my best friend? Aren't they walking much too close together? And it don't look like they're talking about the weather." And then it goes, you know, "Hey, I must be seeing things. This can't be." Like that. That was typical of those songs we wrote at that time.
My guest is Al Cooper. He has a new double CD called Rare and Well Done, The Greatest and Most Obscure Recordings, 1964 to 2001. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Al Cooper has a new double CD retrospective called Rare and Well Done. I spoke with him in 1998 after he revised and expanded his memoirs. Well, in the 1960s, you met Bob Dylan through Dylan's record producer of the time, Tom Wilson. And this was in what year, about?
1965.
65. And Tom Wilson had just cut Dylan's first electric single, Subterranean Homesick Blues. And he invited you to watch Dylan at a session. And you were determined, you say, to do more than watch. You wanted to actually play on it. The session turned out to be the session for Highway 61 Revisited, in which Like a Rolling Stone was recorded. And you played Hammond B3 on Like a Rolling Stone. How did you get to play on it?
Well, I was just determined to play. I was a guitar player at the time, and I stayed up all night practicing and had a... actually an inflated opinion of my ability as a guitar player. And I got to the session, and at the time I was playing guitar on records as a session musician. So the other musicians that were there early when I got there did not think it was unusual for me to be there with my guitar, because I'd played sessions with them, and they knew that I did session work. And I set up my stuff, and I sat down, and I waited, and Dylan came in with a guitar player who was roughly my age, and he sat down, and started warming up, and I realized I was in way over my head. He was the best guitar player I'd ever heard in my life, just warming up. Just the things he was playing were way beyond my grasp as a player. And I said to myself, I got to get out of here before I really embarrass myself. So when there was a moment, I took my guitar and put it in the case and put it against the wall, and I went in the control room where I belonged and watched the session. And Tom Wilson came in, and he hadn't seen me sitting out there with the guitar, so that was very good. And then during the session, they had someone playing the organ, and they moved him over to a piano. Actually, his name was Paul Griffin. He was at studio keyboard player. And I walked over to Tom Wilson. I said, "Hey, why don't you let me play organ on this? I got a great part for this." He went, "Oh, man, you're not a organ player. You're a guitar player. You don't play the organ." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I got a great part for this, Tom." And at just at that point, they called him for a phone call. And I thought to myself, well, he didn't say no. He just said I wasn't an organ player. And so I went out and sat down at the organ. And as a matter of fact, if Paul Griffin hadn't have left the organ switched on, that would have been the end of my career, because it's very complicated to turn on a Hammond B3 organ. It takes about 3 separate moves, and you have to know what you're doing. And I didn't. But it was on already, so I was saved. And then Tom Wilson came back out, and he said, "Okay, this is take 6. And then he saw me, and he said, "Hey, what are you doing out there?" And I just started laughing. And he was a gentleman. He just said, okay, let's go. We're rolling. This is take 7. I guess he thought, you know, if I wanted to do this so bad, he would stand behind it because he was my friend.
When you had told Tom Wilson that you had a part worked out in your head, did you really?
No, of course not. 90% ambition.
Okay, so then what happened? They start performing the song.
Well, they were rehearsing for a second, and I kind of got the thing. And the speaker to the organ was very far from where I was sitting at the organ, and it was covered by baffling so that it wouldn't leak into other microphones that were on in the studio. And so I couldn't actually hear what I was playing. And if I put the headphones on, I could kind of hear a little bit of it, but hear the other things that were much louder, like the guitar. And I didn't have any music to read. I had to do it by ear, which I was used to doing because of playing on sessions as a guitar player. And I just kind of, you know, muddled my way through it, and it was the only complete take of the day. So they went in to play it back and listen to it. And during the playback, Dylan went over to Tom Wilson and said, "Hey, turn the organ up." And he said, "Oh, man, that guy's not an organ player." He says, "I don't care, turn the organ up." And that's how I became an organ player.
Well, let's hear Like a Rolling Stone with my guest Al Cooper featured on organ.
Time you dress so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. So loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without? Complete unknown, like a rolling stone.
my guest Al Kooper, featured on organ. Al Kooper, were you surprised at the impact that organ line had on pop music?
Well, I mean, it was ironically hilarious because here's a guy that really didn't know what he was doing, playing Hunt and Peck organ, and like a whole style of organ playing came out of that. It founded like a whole style of organ playing, which, as we sit here, was really based on ignorance. But that's what's so great about rock. That's what makes rock and roll so great, is something like that could happen.
Now, in your memoir, you write that you used to take records that were people, like bands copying what they heard on Dylan records and play them for Dylan, and that would be really amusing. So I brought in one for you to hear. I don't know if you know this one or not, but this is one that I think is really so inspired by like a Rolling Stone and has a, I don't know, a kind of cheesy organ or electric piano. I'm not sure which it is that seems to be inspired by your part. So let me play it for you and see what you think.
But since this is your public execution, I think I'm gonna go right on ahead. Mailman brought your letter, babe, where you told me how you feel and about the things he said he told you, and that is I'm such a heel. But I could never be honest that to you I'd always lied, that he saw me take some other hide for a two-wheel.
Okay, that was a song.
Don't tell me what it was, because I'm going to tell you what it
was.
Oh,
good. Okay. Go ahead.
That was Mouse in the Traps with A Public Execution.
Correct. And it's one of the records on that great anthology, Nuggets. A little Woolly Bully action in there, too, I think.
Well, yeah, it is, by the way, a very cheesy organ, probably a uh-huh. Farfisa.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, that was one of the records that we laughed at back then.
So you played that for Dylan when it came out?
Well, as we both used to listen to them. It wasn't, you know, I'd go to the record store and then we'd go back to his house and we'd put all these records on and just sit there and laugh.
Now, the record that you first made with Dylan, got you started in a longer relationship with him, you know, playing with him, and you played with him at the Newport Festival, his first you know, like electric concert, and it's a concert that's famous because Dylan got booed. And in your memoir, you kind of have a different interpretation of why he was getting booed. The standard interpretation is because he had electric instruments, the audience was really angry and thought that he'd sold out, etc., and they were booing him. What's your explanation?
Well, many people came to that festival, which was a 3-day festival, like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, to see Dylan, because he was like the king of folk music at the time, and he was the headliner of the festival and was playing the final set on Sunday night. And so primarily a college-age crowd came, and they sat through many musics over the 3-day period under the umbrella of folk music that I'm sure that they didn't care for. And most people played 45-minute to an hour sets, and then we came out and we played for 15 minutes, three electric songs. And I think the people were horrified and incensed that we only played for 15 minutes.
But weren't they booing during the performance too, though?
No.
No?
You find me some oral record of that and I'll be very surprised. There was an undercurrent of the festival directors that were very upset with Dylan playing electric. That is a fact, and that is true. But that really had no way of making itself known to the audience that was attending the thing, other than through the press later on, after the festival was over, which is how that myth came to be promulgated. after the festival, that's what the press wrote about, because they were privy to the fact that Pete Seeger and Alan Lomax were very upset with the electrification that Dylan was doing. And in fact, there were other acts that played electric at that festival that nobody got bent out of shape about, like the Chambers Brothers and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. And they didn't get booed because they played electric.
My guest is Al Cooper. He has a new double CD called Rare and Well Done, the greatest and most obscure recordings, 1964 to 2001. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Al Cooper. He has a new double CD retrospective called Rare and Well Done. In the mid-60s, he played with the band The Blues Project. After leaving that band, he co-founded Blood, Sweat, and Tears. I asked him about the sound he wanted.
Well, I had written a group of songs that, to me, sounded like they would sound best with horns in them. And I brought that idea to The Blues Project, and they said that they didn't want to add horns. So, basically, I left the band and went to put together a band that would have horns and that I could perform these songs with.
Why'd you want the horns so much?
The songs just kind of dictated that they have horns in them. I don't know what it was. It was, you know, sort of magic in a way.
Is there a song you want to play that captures the way you wanted to use horns?
I would say probably I Can't Quit Her or I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know. Either one of those.
Okay.
Or My Days Are Numbered.
Why don't we hear I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know, and we'll start this a little deep into it where the horns start to become prominent. This is Blood, Sweat, and Tears. My guest is Al Cooper.
When I wasn't making too much money, you know where my paycheck went. And I never spent one red cent. Is that a way for a man to carry on? You think it won't, his little loved one gone. I love you, baby, more than you'll ever know. More than you'll ever know. Everything that you demand, I could be president of General Motors, baby, or just a tiny little grain of sand. Is that in a way for a man to carry on? You think it won't, his little love.
gone. I love you, baby. I love you, baby. I love you more than you'll ever know.
Now, Cooper, had you worked with horns like this before?
Just in, there was a period in my life where I wrote ghost arrangements, and I wrote for horns in that situation. But I had not really been in a band with a horn section, no. I had admired Maynard Ferguson's jazz group, which had a large horn section, and that was sort of my model for Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
You know, you write in your book that aging in pop business is always held against you, that, you know, if you're older, you're seen as not being cutting edge anymore and, you know, therefore washed up.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate portrayal of the music business.
Mm-hmm.
Except maybe, you know, in the blues area where
right.
they respect seniority.
That's true. That is really true, yeah. It's true in some rock and roll, too, like, you know, I mean, the Rolling Stones can get as old as whatever.
Oh, yeah. No, there are exceptions to the rule, and there are people that are really fortunate enough to keep going, but there are many that don't. And the other thing is that, you know, take a person like Bob Dylan or Sly and the Family Stone. These are people that made incredible music, and yet the society is geared up and insists that they must continue doing that for the rest of their lives, or they're horrible people, or they're washed up, they're through. But I mean, if you look at the body of work that Sly and the Family Stone left us, it doesn't matter if he writes another song again. He changed music forever and was an incredibly strong influence on the way music is being played today in the R&B field. Everyone owes a debt to him. And yet, you know, people go, he's through, he's a drug casualty. He is none of those things. He is a strong influence in the history of music.
Al Cooper, I really appreciate your talking with us, and I want to thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Al Cooper recorded in 1998. He has a new double CD called Rare and Well Done, the greatest and most obscure recordings, 1964 to 2001. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Hall, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Love is a beautiful thing when it knows how to swing and it grooves like a clock. But the hands on the clock tell the lovers to part, and it's breaking my heart to spend another day without her.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Living Terrors, What America Needs to Know to Survive the Coming Bioterrorist Catastrophe by Dr. Michael Osterholm and John Schwartz. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Hanif Qureshi. He's written about Pakistani immigrants in London in his screenplays My Beautiful Laundrette and My Son the Fanatic. His novella Intimacy has just been adapted into a new film. Also, choreographer Garth Fagan discusses his new dance, In Memoriam, a response to September 11th. Join us for the next Fresh Air.